Welcome to Unpacking the Digital Shelf, where we explore brand manufacturing in the digital age. Brands are now spending upwards of $15 billion a year to manage and activate their influencer marketing programs. It's grown from a few celebrities posting a cat video to millions of micro-influencers driving impact throughout the sales funnel. Rob and I sat down with Lyle Stevens, co-founder and CEO of Maverick, an influencer marketing platform, to identify what shifts are required across teams and processes to manage and optimize the impact of influencer marketing on your business. Take a listen. So Lyle, thank you so much for joining us on Unpacking the Digital Shelf, particularly in these moments where authenticity matters probably more than ever, and people rely more on voices that they trust or that engage them. I think influencer marketing, I would imagine, as a category of marketing work is ever more important. And I was just wondering, maybe as a way of setting the table before we go to what the heck's changing in this current moment, I think just give everyone kind of the base explanation of the role influencer marketing has been playing in commerce and what brought Maverick to life in response.
Yeah, great question. And you know, influencer marketing has been a buzzword for a couple of years now, but with everything going on in the world, it's become even more resurgent. And so the way we think about influencer marketing at Maverick, which is a SaaS platform that helps brands partner with influencers to create content at scale, influencer marketing is really this methodology of using people, a person or a group of people who are trusted, respected, or even revered to help get a message out. And that influence that they wield is empirically evident and valid. And some folks may debate the empirical nature of it, whether it's followers, visitors, subscribers, engagements, views, clicks, you name it. But there is some tangible way to define and measure the empirical nature of their influence that they wield either online or offline. And it's been a burgeoning practice. Traditionally, it's been associated with actresses, artists, athletes, even journalists, or even political or business leaders. But thanks to the power of our smartphone and the camera associated with that smartphone, what used to cost thousands of dollars and only available to a few has now become democratized and available to many because it now sits in your pocket and costs $50 a month. And this mass adoption of social media combined with the power of your smartphone has democratized influence to the point where millions of people now wield influence in an empirical way. And it's allowed the mass adoption of influencer marketing as a practice by marketers in a tremendous sense.
Is it true that there's also now like actual virtual influencers?
It's gotten to a point where it's so empirical that you can use VR, AR, and AI to actually create not real people that simulate human behavior and human content on an Instagram or a YouTube and actually still wield that same influence because those folks are shifting perception, demonstrating expertise, or even being revered by their audiences still, and therefore reflecting influence even though they don't actually exist in real life. So it's a fascinating time for influencer marketing.
Yeah, I almost feel I probably would be better off as a virtual influencer. Well, we're going to have to work on that, Rob. So tell me a little bit, you know, the as you said, the smartphone sort of exploding this thing.
Yeah.
How do you measure the impact that it's had so far? Like, what has the growth been like?
Well, we look at a few different things at Maverick. I mean, the first thing we look at, like most marketers, is what are people searching for and what's going on Google? That's the first thing that usually someone does when they're going to buy something, whether it's on the B2B side or the B2C side. And influencer marketing as a topic has grown exponentially in the last few years on Google search trends to the point now where, as of 2018, it's more popular as a search trend than social media marketing is as a search trend. It eclipsed what would be its like greater cousin in marketing, if you will, in terms of that volume. And that's definitely because of both the marketer looking for influencer marketing, but then also the consumer who seeks to become an influencer looking for influencer marketing. So both sides of the dynamic are aiding in that. We've also seen the industry spend on influencer marketing exponentially from less than $1 billion a few years ago to definitely multi-billion dollars today. You know, some argue 10 billion, some argue 15 billion. It's a matter of whether you include the incentives that go to influencers or whether you're just including the marketing spend on software and the personnel running influencer marketing. Mm-hmm. But it's certainly a multi-billion dollar industry at this point.
It's actually, it's smaller than, but in comparable scale to Amazon advertising, if we're looking for a trend. So that's huge. It's actually a lot bigger than I knew and would have guessed.
Right. Yeah. I think a lot of folks think of influencer marketing as this small little tactical toolkit, but it's actually become a burgeoning strategic practice that's standing on its own apart from other tactics that you can use as a marketer.
I know that when I visit people in Brooklyn, the joke is you walk around and there's everybody's an influencer. It's like they got the selfie stick and you've got the camera out there and they're all talking in, and then they screw up the take and they bring their phone back in from the selfie stick and hit delete and hit re-record and put the stick back out there. And
that's right. Yeah. You definitely see, you know, the idea of an Instagram husband, it has emerged for a real reason. I qualify as one of those. My wife has started her own blog and has her own Instagram account. And I'm certainly behind the camera very often for that. And this idea for a gig economy is helped, right? There's folks that are looking to have side hustles and find new ways of providing for their families, and producing content with the democratized tools that they have access to now is certainly become popular.
What's so interesting about this explosion here is the original influencer was, when it comes to influencing shopping patterns, was Michael Jordan, right? It's like, like Mike.
That's right. I thought you were going to say God was the first. But then you said shopping and I was like, okay.
Oh yeah, I guess the real OG, right? But right. But more recently and down here in consumer retail is Be Like Mike. And then and in that era, you're trying to sell Nike to everybody who puts things on their feet, right? Anybody who's a possible footwear athletic purchaser is the audience for Be Like Mike. But these days the influencers are really specific to niche audiences, and the specificity can sometimes make them extremely valuable, right?
That's right. And that comes down to the empirical nature of influencer marketing today. I can find someone in a very niche category, topic, region of the world that is talking with authority and engaged audiences around that topic. And I can activate them in mass too. So I can then find 100 or thousands of these people that then when combined have actually greater impact than Michael Jordan had as a standalone. And that's the power of influencer marketing today.
Okay. So we've got the trend now over the last 5-6 years has been going from a niche subset of social media marketing to its own category of marketing, going from $0 of spend to $15 billion of spend, which is just wild to me. What are the shifts that are happening within the influencer space right now that you're seeing that are structural in nature or really interesting?
Yeah, as a result of this democratization, we're seeing who manages influencer marketing shifting, who participates as an influencer shifting, the various ways you recruit and find influencers shifting, the use cases, and ultimately how you measure influencer marketing. So truly fundamental shifts are happening and have been happening over the last 18 months or so across the practice. And they're really exciting for us to be a part of here at Maverick, and then marketers obviously taking advantage of those shifts have produced amazing results for them and their brands.
Okay, well, let's start with the first one of those, the who manages it. I mean, one of the frequent topics that we have at the Digital Shelf Institute is the notion that silos within large manufacturers in particular need to be broken down in order to execute online strategies more effectively. So supply chain and marketing, media, and the trade teams, which can operate relatively independently of each other for traditional retail. If you're executing on Amazon, they all have to be part of the same strike team, basically.
Right.
And so who traditionally has owned the social the influencers, and who will own or is starting to own the influencers going forward?
Yeah, one of my favorite trends is that influencer marketing traditionally was owned by a third-party agency, paid media agency, advertising agency, who was responsible for media and media channels, because influencers were traditionally looked at as just another media channel. And sometimes you'd see PR teams own it in-house and social teams own it in-house, again, as a media channel. But as more types of influencers have emerged, for example, this idea of a micro-influencer, which is an individual who has a day job like you and I, but then has a side hustle creating this content. Maybe they have 10,000, maybe they have 100,000 followers, but somewhere between that size audience. Activating those individuals at a different scale and also at a different cost equation has allowed other teams to take advantage of influencer marketing, like the e-commerce team, like the loyalty team, like the digital team. And as a result of that, influencer marketing is bridging the gap between a media team, a traditional social or PR team, and the e-commerce team, because influencer marketing will help create brand awareness or be a media channel. And the asset that was displayed in that media channel is then pulled into an e-commerce experience and repurposed to drive additional value, whether it's on a product details page, driving more conversion rates, or after I take that photo and 60 days later, I write a rating and review of that product that's also then redisplayed. And so there's a lot more collaboration happening across these marketing departments, and e-commerce, loyalty, performance-based marketers are using influencers more so than ever before.
So that actually, you would also mention another major shift has to do with the KPIs. Like, I'd imagine that if the influencers are owned primarily by the media teams, they're talking about reach as and reach-like metrics as the primary way that they're successful. But right. If the e-commerce team is involved, e-commerce doesn't really care that much about reach. They care about sales. So that would indicate to me that the influencers are moving further down the funnel in terms of impact on conversions. How are they measuring that effectively? What metrics does an e-commerce team that engages with influencers look at?
Yeah. So Rod, you're exactly right. You know, 3 years ago, 2017, you know, 80% of influencer marketing campaigns were measured through awareness and reach and things like impressions, views, engagement, maybe brand lift, share of voice, like very top funnel type of metrics. And 20% of the time, maybe there were some other objectives. Fast forward to today, you still have 40% of marketers looking at influencers for awareness. So that hasn't changed and gone away completely, but it's definitely shifted. And now almost equivalent number of marketers are looking at sales, offline sales lift, attributed online sales based either on tracking links or promo codes, increases in lifetime value or loyalty behavior, and improved conversion rates when you produce influencer content, namely photos or ratings and reviews, and then syndicate that content either across your own e-commerce sites or your third-party e-commerce sites, you're driving conversion rates on those locations as well. And those have become the more popular KPIs for those looking to drive sales. And we're still looking, we see other folks also look at content assets. They want a number of posts or photos or videos as a secondary metric, but sales have become more prevalent than ever before as part of the KPI mix for influencer marketing.
So one of the things that we had talked about before is the relation of that trend to affiliate marketing.
Right.
Where, there's a certain type of influencer that is a pure play on the affiliate side. So the classic example that validated the space was Wirecutter, which was then purchased by the New York Times. And Wirecutter is like a modern online consumer reports for millennials. So you figure out what vacuum cleaner you want to buy. You go to Wirecutter. They tell you, you click on the link, it takes you to Amazon, and Wirecutter gets a cut of that transaction.
Right.
So how is what you're talking about in terms of the influencers, the attribution links and stuff like that, is it simply riding on the back of what affiliate marketing is, or is it something different or more than that?
I would say it's affiliate marketing plus. I think there's definitely been inspiration from affiliate marketing, and we're certainly using partnerships with affiliate marketers to produce some of those tracking links that a brand has already partnered with prior to working with a Maverick. But what we've also seen is this idea that because the affiliate commissions are starting to become squeezed in affiliate marketing, Amazon being the most recent example where they cut their rates from anywhere from 8% down to 3%, influencers or publishers, as they're often called in the affiliate space, are now seeking alternative revenue streams, which is leading towards more folks looking at the modern day influencer marketing of creating social content, video content, photo content, and getting and monetizing that photo content and video content in alternative ways, whether it's on a per post basis, could still be on a performance basis, but not so much as a last click, performance basis. Maybe it's on an attributed basis when that asset is used someplace else outside of their traditional social channels. And so that's what we're starting to see as it pertains to affiliate marketing.
And that's sort of when I think about trying to do that at scale with, you know, however many thousands of micro influencers that you're trying to manage at any one time, what is it like to recruit them? But then also, what is the contractual agreement that allows you to be able to reuse their content? Or when you talk about sort of the channels you want deployed to all the way to the PDP, how do you make all of that happen at scale?
Yeah, I mean, transparently, that's where software like Maverick comes in. We help orchestrate that workflow and automate many of the steps that was done manually, whether via cold email and spreadsheet tracking. That's where marketers started with influencer marketing. But today, when you look at your existing customers that are already visiting your website and they're shopping and knowing and buying your brand, we are seeing roughly 8% of them have relevant micro-influence, any 8%. And so identifying that person either post-checkout or as another part of your consumer journey, inviting them to join an influencer or ambassador program, and they raise their hand and they opt in, that gives software like Maverick permission to analyze and get permission to understand what this person looks like from an influence perspective. And then if they fit the criteria, whether that's based on their audience, based on their content quality, based on historical performance of folks that are similar to them, you then can reach out and provide them with some sort of incentivization model. And within that model, we've seen a shift from primarily based on cash, whether it's activity-based, here's $100 to create a post, and then here's 10% when you actually drive sales, to, well, since you love my brand, and I know you already shop with my brand because I found you through engaging with my brand, why don't I give you products or gift cards or even loyalty points? We're seeing loyalty as a larger component of the influencer mix, or the influencer incentive mix, I should say, than ever before. And as a result, influencers are now shifting or migrating away from this transactional relationship where I'm just looking for the person with the highest bid on cash to a brand I actually know and love who's giving me something that I want. And now I'm willing to work with this brand for a long time and build a long-term relationship.
So if I look at it, man, this is just so interesting. Like the fact that you can manage influencers at scale to really niche down your targeting. This is like Facebook advertising's promise, right? Where you can do really, really tight demographic advertising, and Facebook's built an empire on that capability.
Right.
One of the mega trends that I think is really interesting in the last 12 years, you know, since the Great Recession, is you look World War II to Great Recession, the percentage of US GDP that's spent on advertising is about a point and a quarter for that entire period of time. Sometimes a little up, sometimes a little down. Since 2008, it's been under a percentage point. It's like advertising as a percentage of GDP plummeted and has stayed low. And over that time, the media mix has shifted so that you're doing less on the major channels. You know, print suffered the most early on, but now you're seeing people pulling upfronts and contracts out of TV into alternative channels. So if I'm a brand, I mean, you gave that $15 billion number on influencer marketing earlier. If I'm a brand and I'm thinking about brand advertising and I'm thinking about cord cutting, millennials and zillennials, and I'm trying to get my brand in front of them to grow, you know, my influence and reach and all this sort of stuff. Are influencers from your perspective the best way to do that today? Like some combination of influencers and Facebook, or is like where do you advise folks to switch their media mix in this new world?
Yeah, if you're reaching or targeting millennials or Gen Z, they're spending their time on social. They're looking for what we call social proof every time they go to buy something, whether it's from someone they know or someone they follow or someone they aspire to be. They're looking for that social validation before they engage with that brand. And they often discover their brands that way. They discover that next shoe or that next workout routine or that next recipe, all via social proof. And so if you're looking for that audience, influencer marketing needs to be at the forefront of your strategy. And you're seeing brands like Revolve, who IPO'd last year. They mentioned influencer marketing more than 70 times in their IPO filing for a reason, because they're going after that exact audience, and they know influencer marketing is the forefront of their strategy. you also see legacy brands like Estee Lauder, who are now spending 75% in the beauty space, which makes obvious sense. They're spending 75% of their marketing budget on influencer marketing.
75% of their marketing budget, Estee?
Right. That's right.
Wow.
That's kind of stunning. Yeah, that is a huge shift.
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about what are the categories? Are there categories that can't play in influencer marketing? If I'm, you know, I'm trying to, maybe you could just sort of from the top ones down. I mean, the thing that comes to mind is poor B2B always gets left out of these things, right? And so I'm thinking of them, like if I'm in food service, you know, when cafeterias come back online at schools, like, is there a reason why I can't find an influencer? If I was, say, involved in, you know, in trying to create a community like the Digital Shelf Institute, are there ways that I could sort of en masse uncover influencers, or is it still a B2C play, and in what categories?
I would say it's certainly dominated by B2C because it's, I would just say, easier to find influencers in a B2C context than it is a B2B context. The B2B data set is probably even more niche than the B2C context, and that's part of the challenge. But we do see influencer marketing work equally as well on the B2B side once you find those people. Podcasts like this one is a great example, and you now see enough folks sharing podcasts on social channels so that you can reach that signal or ingest that signal to find those podcasters and actually engage with them from a B2B context. But there's other channels as well that you should be looking at. Blogs are still very prevalent in the B2B context. So the idea of guest blogging has been around for a long time. And when you're launching a blog for the first time, using influence marketing or influencers and influencer marketing to launch that blog is a key strategy we see on the B2B side all the time.
And is this working for globally? Because I can imagine all of the networks you need to connect to be able to do a global campaign, tentacles worldwide. Is it truly global yet?
It is. It is absolutely global. If you look at those search trends that I mentioned earlier, actually the UK, so EMEA and Latin America are actually looking at influencer marketing more from a Google search perspective than the United States. And then you see the emergence of social channels like TikTok that have grown out of Asia and the Asian Pacific markets and have then now become very popular in the United States. And so influencer marketing is not just an American concept or American strategy, it's very much a global phenomenon and growing faster in some parts of the world than even the United States. Now the spend is very different, and that has to do with the investments of marketing in those parts of the world. But in terms of the consumer adoption of influencer marketing and social media, it is just as prevalent in other parts of the world as it is here.
What's, if any, are influencers that you personally follow and whose things they buy? I mean, for me, the one who has led me to many purchases is Tim Ferriss.
Yeah.
Five Bullet Friday newsletter. I've purchased many things based on his recommendation. Do you have somebody like that?
So I have a few folks that I would put in the influencer category for me, both from a purchase behavior, but then also just from like a discovery perspective. So one of my favorite influencers, because of his snarky perspective and just witty way of creating content, is actually Dude With Sign on Instagram, Seth Phillips.
Dude With Sign?
Yeah. So his content is literally just a static image of him holding up a cardboard sign with a really witty message that is just pithy and to the point and relevant to the times, but it also hits home on whatever's going on and typically has high engagement and then causes me to go maybe Google whatever current event he's referencing, and I just get more engaged with whatever's going on as a result of that. So I would put Dude With Sign high on my list. From a purchase behavior standpoint, I'm actually going to reference someone that my wife looks at all the time and you know, I see reflected in our credit card statements pretty often. And that's Gal Meets Glam, Julia Engel, who's out of San Francisco.
Oh, yeah.
And what's been interesting with her is that she has taken her influence to a whole other level where she actually launched her own brand and created her own dress line. And that's a whole other part of the equation that we're starting to see, where the evolution of an influencer is getting to a point where now they are becoming brands in their own way. Launching their own product lines in their own way and creating their own direct-to-consumer commerce business as a result of the influence that they've evolved and wielded. So that's a whole nother.
Yeah, but doesn't that, because they're essentially setting themselves up as competitors to the people who used to hire them as an influencer. Like, so they, that's sort of, that's a risk-taking enterprise saying, because what, you know, what competitor is now going to still use her as a, as an influencer for their product if it's, if she's selling a competitive one, I would think. Like, so she probably made a decision to take a leap, like to be her own influencer. That I, that that must be a fascinating, when do you pull that?
From my perspective, it certainly has a lot to do with the incentivization model. So once you get to that size and you're driving that degree of influence and you're driving clear purchase behavior for the likes of Nordstrom's or other fashion brands specifically, and using affiliate platforms to measure that sale, reward style being a very common one within the fashion category, you then start to price yourself out unless you're only driving sales. And then if you're driving sales at that volume, why not drive sales to your own product so you can increase the commission rate for yourself? And so that's the inflection point, is that she probably saw, I'm driving 10% in commission, 3%, whatever it was in commission to this larger brand. I can retain 50% cost of goods sold component when it's my own product, right? And that's essentially what's happening with some of these large influencers, is they're realizing when I create my own brand, my commission rate goes up because it's my own product. And it's as simple as that.
Now, I have friends who are micro influencers, and the amount of work they put into it is unbelievable.
Yeah, it's definitely a full-time job. Yeah.
And it infuses every, I'm overstating it, but so much time of every interaction that they're having in their regular life. Like every moment is sort of, is this worth capturing? It's a really interesting shift.
Sure. Yeah. There's certainly pros and cons to that, right? One of the common pieces of feedback that we hear from marketers, but also just from consumers, is that influencer marketing can sometimes be perceived as fake and having like that rose-colored perception of the world as a result. What's happened specifically around COVID-19 and the pandemic is a shift from that perfect and that image of perfection, like on Instagram, to live streaming and what I'm doing in the moment. And it's not edited, it's not perfected, it's in the moment. And as a result, more influencers are becoming comfortable with that idea of being more raw, more authentic, not putting up the perfect beauty routine or the perfect image of life, actually driving more authenticity, more engagement, and actually more benefit to the marketer. So it's been a pretty interesting shift to watch in the recent months, at least.
This is like a version of the Truman Show, except like the Truman Show by selfie.
Yes, it totally is.
The way that you guys are describing it, it's like all this show me all the time doing my own thing and across every aspect of my life. Man, not for nothing, but that seems really stressful to me.
It is.
Oh, no, it'll be a nightmare for me, but I'm clearly not the demographic that's making this work.
Yeah, when we talk to influencers and creators, one of the things we often ask is, how do you cope with the pressure to be on all the time and to be available and to be responsive to your audience who's craving that reaction? And it's hard. And that's where a lot of the time goes. It's certainly coming up with the content and producing the content takes up time, but just engaging and being present as an individual is equally as taxing for these influencers and creators.
Yes, as the host of Unpacking the Digital Shelf, I can totally identify with that pressure of managing, telling stories on a good note. It's nothing like that. So to close out, you know, if you think of, you know, sort of identify yourself with our audience here, they're marketing and e-commerce executives who are trying to make the most of these sort of new ways to connect with consumers and do it at a scale that's reasonable. If you had three pieces of advice to sort of throw out to these folks to think about how they should guide their teams to either explore this or maybe change the way they're approaching it now, what might that be?
Yeah, I think the first one is just to think about influencer marketing as and influencers as more than a media channel. They are a media channel, but they're more than that. They're a source of high quality photography, a source of ratings and reviews of your product and how people experience your product. And even more so, they're a source of validated expertise and perspective that can be used in research and insights, whether you're launching a new product, rebranding, or launching a new marketing campaign. Using an influencer or creator at the front end of the process versus just at the back end as a distribution channel is something I would encourage every marketer to think about.
Can you tell me a little bit, Jessica? I think that's particularly interesting. Like, how do you use them at the front of the process?
Well, so if you think through how traditional research organizations or digital focus groups are done, it's very much a self-proclaimed expert saying, yes, I'm a beer expert. I drink beer every day, right? And maybe that's not the best example, but I'm a sneakerhead, or I'm really into running or shoes, right? With influencers, you can actually validate that an audience around that topic, that they're creating content around that topic, and people actually listen to them around that topic versus someone who's just self-reporting that they're an expert. And as a result of that, you get unique insights around that topic or perspective. But the other piece of this is that they're also marketers. They're experts in how to engage an audience and create great content and understand the cultural moments that are relevant to consumers and what's going on in the zeitgeist. And you combine those two things, the expertise with a marketing lens and the fact that they're a consumer at the end of the day, you get some really rich insights, more so than you would get out of a traditional focus group from what we've seen. And we see a number of our customers doing that now.
So if you've got your mindset about thinking about using influencers in different parts of sort of your product life cycle, what's your next piece of advice once you've got that sorted out?
The next thing I'd recommend to marketers is think about different ways to recruit and find influencers. Too often I see a marketer say, oh, I just need to go find a third party platform or partner that has a cohort of influencers that I can then reach out to and bid. And that certainly is part of the equation. And that's something that can help you add scale to your influencer marketing. But I always encourage marketers to look right at home at their own brand, the folks that are shopping on their website, that are subscribing to their newsletter, and just ask them to raise their hand and join your influencer program or apply to your ambassador program. And you'll be shocked at how many folks raise their hand and have relevant influence. We've seen beauty brands get tens of thousands of people to raise their hand in the first 3 months of doing so, and they activate most of them to create content. We've seen fashion brands, we've seen CPG brands, we've seen a number of different categories look at their own existing customers, whether it's loyalty shoppers, app users, newsletter subscribers. You believe it or not, you have more assets to find influencers already that you're probably underutilizing.
And then finally, how do you make all this work? How do you, we talked earlier about sort of closing the deal with them. Like, what's the way to make sure you get the results that you want?
It comes back to the right incentive and motivating them the right way. And if you're using them for more than a social media channel or a media distribution channel, and you're finding them from your own existing customers, using incentives that are aligned with your brand, like product, like discounts, like loyalty points, that's very common, as I mentioned earlier, using unique and brand aligned incentivization models will maximize the ROI you're getting out of your influencer practice.
Well, Lyle, thank you so much for coming on and just giving us some schooling on what's going on, particularly in these moments in influencer marketing. I think it's going to be a fascinating piece of the mix to watch and see how it changes over the next couple of years. So we really appreciate you bringing it here.
Of course. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it as well.
That's it for our podcast. Before you do anything else today, please, please sign up to be in the audience of our very first virtually live podcast on June 10th, featuring Rob and me grilling Brent Baum, who's the CEO of BigCommerce, on the rise of D2C and controlling your own destiny in commerce. Raise your hand, ask a question live. Sign up at digitalshelfsummit.salsify.com. Thanks for being part of our community.